You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Couples counseling. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Yes, couples counseling. I do progressives and the Obama administration need couples counseling? I got a question to share with you, a thought, actually, and hopefully some useful insights here in this first hour. In our second hour, Mark Williams is going to drop by. 3,500 different genetic faults we can test for now. Do you want to know when you're 5 years old, 10 years old, 20 years old, that the probabilities of you getting cancer when you're 30 are really high? Or dying of a heart attack at 40? Or would you rather just live your life not knowing that there's an anvil hanging by a very thin rope above your head? So this is a tough one. And in our third hour today, Dr. Ravi Batra will be here with us. Get your questions ready. Of course, not investment advice. Dr. Batra is a professor of economics at Southern Methodist University and the author of a number of books, New York Times and international best-selling books on economics. But questions you have about how the economy works, where the economy is going to be going, what about Europe, any of those kinds of issues, Ravi Batra is the guy. But in this first hour, the question that has been, you know, nagging at me is, how do we achieve some sort of a political balance? Let me lay this out. You know, when people have a relationship, when people first fall in love, and this isn't just falling in love, you meet your next door neighbor, you know, new friend, right? The natural thing, a new person at work. The natural thing that people do is they try to find all the areas where they agree, where they have all their commonalities. What do you have in common? Oh, I'm an old ham radio. Oh, you're a ham radio operator. So, you know, or hey, I love music. Well, what kind of music? Oh, I like, Bach. Oh, I love, you know, whatever. And so early in relationships, there's this process of finding out how you're the same. And, you know, whether that leads to a sense of friendship or camaraderie or communication or falling in love, you know, you add a little sexual attraction to it, boom. And then after some time, you discover, you know, we're not really the same person. We're not all that alike. We have differences. And for many people, and I actually, you know, in the course of my life, I've known a few people who just never were able to maintain a long-term relationship. Because if you were to ask them, they would say, oh, I never found the right person. Because their definition of right is very, very narrow, and it typically is just like me. Sorry, there's no such person out there like that. Unless you can clone yourself. Now, this is not to knock people who have not been in long-term relationships. But the point is that there is this, it's got to be perfect syndrome that a very small number of people have with regard to relationships, an increasingly large number of people have with regard to politics. And, you know, what got me going on this was I got an email this morning from, got me thinking about it. I mean, we've talked about this on the radio in the past, but never at some great length. Got an email this morning from an acquaintance, a fellow author, progressive, who has just been who was forwarding an article that was written by somebody who was taking, you know, pot shots at President Obama. And I can and have, on many occasions on this program, give you a long list of things where Obama and I are different, where I differ from him. But where this guy is stuck is in that stage two thing where, you know, typically what happens is the first stage is the honeymoon, the second stage is the honeymoon's over. And either people feel horrified and betrayed when they discover that the other person isn't just like them, and they leave, or in the case of politics, they spend the next 4 years trashing the person. Or they do the grown-up and mature thing, which is to say, you know, you're not just like me. But we have enough in common that we can build a relationship. And maybe even a life together. Or a friendship. And be friends for years and years. Or a political relationship, and we can accomplish a lot of the things that we do agree on, and we can continue to disagree about the things that we disagree on, but keep talking. And so I guess my question for today, and this is one that I genuinely don't have the answer to, is, how do you help somebody mature? How do you help somebody grow up? How do you help somebody realize that there's no perfect politician? That, you know, oh, lesser of two evils, all that kind of stuff. Well, yeah, if you are in a long-term relationship, if you're married, I guarantee you, you're married to the lesser of two evils, or of 500 evils, or however many people you met in your life who you thought, is this the one? I could give you a long list of things where Louise and I disagree. We've been married for over 3 decades. And yet, you know, we're still together and pleased, both of us, very much by it. You know, there's food she likes I can't stand, and vice versa, for example. This is just normal stuff. Grown-ups figure this out. People who are, I was going to say emotionally immature, but, you know, it sounds like a slap. I mean, you know, yesterday I was throwing around the fascist word. But I don't think that we even have in our culture a word that describes it. Maybe perfectionist, you know, that doesn't have an emotional charge associated with it. But there are folks who will say, no, I'm not going to participate in that. I'm not going to support that person. I'm not going to, whatever it may be. And I'm not just talking about Obama here. I mean, I guarantee you, we can find things we disagree with Bernie Sanders about. I can't think of any off the top of my head, but I'm sure if I talk. But see, that's, I mean, you know, what is that, the honeymoon? There will be those things. So how do we talk to our friends about politics and help them re-engage, help them get engaged when they're in that second stage? Because the third stage, by the way, when you say, yes, you're not like me, but we do have a lot in common, and we do have shared goals, that's when you actually have real love. That's when the relationship becomes mature. That's when it becomes healthy. That's when it becomes, you know, stable, relatively speaking. How do we talk about that? What do we do? How have you done that? Or do you think I'm totally wrong? Do you think that we really should be, hey, it's all black and white, this person isn't perfect, to hell with them? Drones, I can't put up with drones. Therefore, I'll blow everything else away. I mean, is that how it should be in politics? It's a nuanced conversation, I realize. So I'm curious what your nuance is. I've got some thoughts I'll add right after this. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And movement politics, frankly, I think is a piece of this, which is, okay, I can engage in politics, but I don't have to be totally clear.
So in love. Let's stay together, loving you weather, time to
do we stay together for the good and the bad or not? You know, for example, somebody from Free Speech TV was one of the viewers was just mentioning this trade deal that the Obama administration is apparently putting together behind closed doors that echoes language that's already in trade deals that we've had since the Reagan administration and in large part since the Clinton administration with NAFTA and the WTO. Both our NAFTA agreements and our WTO agreements say that transnational corporations can sue us and have our laws overturned. In fact, almost all of the trade agreements say that. And it's happened. We used to have a law that said that, and in fact, it took 25 years. The Humane Society started the championing this the dolphin safe tuna because they used to use these giant nets that to scoop up the tuna. Tuna will swim below dolphins, or dolphins will swim above tuna. I guess really is what it is because the tuna are predators and they're eating things and they leave a lot of debris and then the dolphins eat the debris as it floats up. The mangled fish bodies and things. And so, they'd find a bunch of dolphin in the ocean, scoop them up along with a tuna underneath them in a giant net, kill the dolphins. So 25 years of lobbying, we got a law passed saying you can't do this anymore. And because we signed the North American Free Trade Agreement, Mexico sued us and said that's an illegal restraint of trade because our fishermen use those nets, even though your fishermen are now starting to use long lines. And so we had to blow up the law. This is why I'm opposed to all of these trade agreements. But anyhow, this person said, this is a bridge too far for me. Okay. So what's the bridge too far? Where, at what point do you say, no, I want a divorce? And if you do that, where do you go? I mean, in love and romance, you get a divorce, you can go off and find somebody else. But how many other people are running for president or for senator or for member of House of Representatives or for city council? We don't have proportional representation in the United States. How do you reach out? Here's the two big questions, I think. Number one is, how do we reach out to people who've walked away already? The people who have basically given up. The people who have looked at the situation, who have looked at the, and for one of two reasons, typically. Either out of disgust and cynicism, or they just never, in the first place, ever got engaged in politics. For one of those two reasons, are watching sports, listening to rock and roll, or country western, whatever it may be, and not paying attention to politics until a week before the election, and then they just watch the TV ads and say, okay, that one sounds good, I'll vote for that person. How do we engage those people? Number one. And number two, if Carl Jung was right, back in the 1890s, when he came up with this notion that there are people who are born this way, who are judgers, this small percentage, 15-20% of us are judgers. We see the world in black and white. Everything is binary. It's good or it's bad. It works or it doesn't work, right? Versus the 70-80% of us who are perceivers, who see all the shades of gray. How do perceivers talk to judges who have said, no, I'm walking away? In a relationship, one of the most destructive things you can do in a relationship is to stop communicating, is to walk away, is to freeze out the other person, say, no, I'm not going to have anything to do with you. In fact, it's probably that and hitting below the belt. Because in intimate relationships over time, you get to know the other person's sensitive areas and vulnerabilities and what actually will wound them. I mean, that's part of intimacy. And using those against the other person, those are probably the two most destructive things in relationships, things that you just shouldn't do. And yet in politics, it seems to me that there's a fair amount of both going on. On both sides. I mean, it's funny going to CPAC all these years and sitting and talking with these conservatives and listening to them and debating them and whatnot, how much they hated Mitt Romney. I mean, you know, what, people walking around in dolphin outfits at CPAC year after year, flipper, right? Flip-flop. Handing out giant, you know, mittens that have dolphins on them and things like that. But now they're, by and large, coming together and saying, you know, the Supreme Court's more important. Or, you know, the billionaires, their interests are more important. I mean, you got Shelley Adelson, he's come out and he's, I'll put $100 million in. This is the guy who was, you know, supporting Newt, as I recall. Or maybe it was Rick, one or the other. In any case, how do we reach out to these folks? Or should we? And at what point do we say, okay, this, here are the differences between us. And, you know, you've got a choice, basically. We can either walk away and say, screw it, not going to be involved. Or we can say, here's how we're going to work around those differences. Or here's how we're even going to work to change the other person. Now, interestingly, in relationships, this is more often a fantasy than not. Oh, you know, yeah, he's obnoxious, but I'll change him, or she's obnoxious, but I'll change her once we get married. Not to, it doesn't work out that way. But in politics, it actually can work out that way. Mitt Romney, case in point, I suppose. But politicians, I mean, their job is to do what the majority of the people want. So our job is to figure out, how do we change them? Well, you can't change a politician, and you can't change a political dialogue if you're not engaged in it. So how do we do that? Okay, those are my thoughts on it. We'll get yours right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And I would say in short form, my takeaway on all this is, don't ever walk away from it. Stay engaged. So welcome back. What do we do? What kind of couples counseling do Obama and progressives need? A. B. How do we re-engage people who have never been engaged in politics or who have given up on politics? And C. How do we heal political dialogue in the United States in general, you know, in the largest sense? I think there's a bunch of different issues here that are raised. And although they all kind of revolve around the same thing. Ellen in Lowell, Massachusetts. Hey, Ellen. Thanks for calling. What's up?
Hi.
Your thoughts on this?
I'm having a fun time listening to you about the idea that we have disagreements on things and you can't just go along with everybody on everything.
Right.
I studied academic theology in college, and my professor at Denison University, Dave Woodyer, when we were having different people's perspectives on the different theologies, it's the same thing. You can't get everybody to believe the same way. He said, let's agree to disagree on that.
Right. And that's...
Agree to disagree.
Yeah, so that's a sensible way to do it, to say, okay, you know, we're not going to convince each other that, you know, but in order to agree to disagree, there have to be other larger issues on which you're agreeing to agree, right? Otherwise,
that there's other things that you are going to agree on, but you're also going to respect the other person's opinion,
right,
and realize that you're not going to try to convince them.
Right. Well said. Ellen,
you
thank you very much for that. Yeah, thank you very much for that.
Dave Woodyard at Denison University.
Okay.
Dr. Woodyard.
Yeah, well credited. Thank you. Ike in Littleton, Colorado. Hey, Ike.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Just fine.
I'm going to kind of give you a two-part story here. A week ago today, about 7:30 in the morning, I went into the hospital to have a leak repaired in my brain. I had a cerebral fluid leak.
Yikes.
From my spine. And a week later, here I am driving my car to the market.
Mm-hmm.
And my point being is, you know, where in the world can you have something like that happen to you and actually get to talk about it, first of all? And the other point is that I think that we have to acknowledge that we have a really great country here. And because of that, I have made sort of the new rules for myself that I'm not going to argue with people that think differently from me. I'm going to try and continue a dialogue and draw those people into a conversation mm-hmm. where we both talk about things that are near and dear to our heart and find some common ground.
Okay. That's a very sensible one, and I appreciate in particular your acknowledgement that this country and you know, the technology have a lot to offer. Well said. Ike, thank you very much for the call. JD in Atlanta. Hey, JD, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was just calling because I think that one of the ways that we can get people more engaged is if they see from the leadership that they are willing to fight and go to bat. And recently with the attacks on, say, Attorney General Eric Holder mm-hmm. and stuff like that, the Democratic leadership has been very quiet. So a lot of my friends are thinking to themselves, well, why should I go out and vote Democratic, or why should I engage in a process when mm-hmm. the people that are elected, the Democratic leaders, are not even in a, I guess to use a football analogy, protecting the quarterback. So I think.
Well, don't you think, though, that Holder is holding? I mean, I thought he made a fool of Daryl Issa the other day.
I do think that I think he's holding his own, but the whole thing about it is, I just think that if you look on the Republican side, if something similar was done to, say, Daryl Issa, there will be 50 Republicans up there coming to his back. And it just seems like with Eric Holder, President yeah. Obama, it's all radio silent. So when you have somebody like myself, who is a teacher, who already feels somewhat marginalized, who already feels somewhat cynical, and then when they see that, I think that if people felt that, gee, if I get engaged, that my voice will actually be fought for, you'll see a lot more people get off the sidelines. So, and, you know, the reason why I called in is when I tried to call the DNC today and try to reach out to other leaders, they told me that's not an issue, that they're not going to work on that, that they're not going to.
The whole Fast and Furious thing. Well, the Fast and Furious thing is an issue that pretty much only exists in one very small world. It exists on Fox News. They're the only network that is reporting on it. And it exists on right-wing talk radio. And in those two universes, they will not point out to you the fact that the whole Fast and Furious program was started under George W. Bush.
True.
That Eric Holder has been totally forthcoming with information. That Daryl Issa himself, back when George W. Bush was president and Democrats were trying to subpoena information from the Justice Department, was supporting Alberto Gonzalez and saying that it was a political witch hunt that Congress was engaged in by trying to, you know, ask Alberto Gonzalez for information about who was being tortured where and when. You know, Daryl Issa is a complete hypocrite on this. And, you know, one of the reasons, for example, why I haven't talked about this much on this program is it just, you know, on the progressive side, nobody is paying attention to it because we all realize that it's nonsense. And that's, you know, and that's that. And there's more important things, frankly. But to your point, and I think that your point is an important one, is that if you feel that the people that you might otherwise be supporting are not out there fighting on your behalf, why should you fight on their behalf? Am I paraphrasing your comments well?
Yeah, you are. And I think to even make it even more lucid for listeners to say like a football team, Obama is the quarterback. Now, if you see your quarterback get a sack, then the people aren't even trying to block or trying to help out. And if you are on the sideline, and the coach calls you to come in, you're not going to run out there with all kinds of zest because you're saying to yourself.
Yeah, or if you're a fan, you don't go to the next game. You go to the bar and you know, drink beer instead of watching the game on TV instead or whatever. I mean, you know, it's mm-hmm. yeah, okay, I get it. JD, I don't have an easy answer for that one, but thank you for, you know, adding a thought provoking dimension to the conversation. I appreciate it. Dan in Warren, Michigan. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Tom. You do a great show.
Thanks.
You mentioned that there's probably two reasons to get the divorce from the parties and the political system, which is cynicism and disgust and never having been engaged. But I think there's a third reason, which is sort of closer to my position, which is just despair and hopelessness. When you see the millions and millions of dollars you're throwing into the political system, you know, what is there to be said or done that can overcome that kind of influence?
Well, Carly Fiorina didn't win the Senate seat in California. Meg Whitman didn't win the governorship. I mean, Jerry Brown spent a fraction. I mean, Meg Whitman was spending millions, tens of millions of dollars of her own money. And Jerry Brown ran a very, very low-key, low-budget campaign, and he's sitting in the governor's office right now. So
But for every one of those stories, I think you have a Scott Walker story where there's millions and millions of dollars from outside of his state.
Right, or the tobacco in California last week story. Sure, they may well be the exception that proves the rule, but at least there's an exception. So I'm a big believer, and I think in this, maybe even believer is the wrong word. Observer, I think, because I believe that this is factual, what I'm observing, is that movement politics, if the movement stays together over time, and sometimes it's generations, movement politics always wins. So, you know, whether it was the suffrage movement, whether it was the abolition movement, whether it was the civil rights movement, whether it was the movement to make alcohol illegal and then the movement to end the prohibition of alcohol, fill in the blanks. We've had a bunch of them, large and small, in this country over the years, that eventually movements win. And so, there's plenty in today's politics that I look at, and, you know, despair isn't the descriptor, the adjective that I would use, if it's an adjective, that I would use. I don't know my parts of speech that well.
Discouraged, at least.
Yeah, whatever. There's a lot of things that I look at and go, damn, you know, I wish that wasn't that way. And that's very upsetting. And what I've learned to do throughout my life, and not just in politics, but in business and in my personal life as well, is that when I get confronted with those kind of emotions, convert them into action. Say, okay, you know, I may not be able to solve this problem. I mean, we're not going to solve tomorrow the problem of what the Supreme Court has done to this country. You know, ever since Lewis Powell was put on the bench back in 73 and the court started recognizing, that money was somehow not property anymore. It was speech. I'm not going to change that tomorrow. But over time, if we can build a movement, we can change that. So I would say movement politics is the best answer to despair. But, Dan, it's an excellent point. It is multidimensional. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Landon in Sequim, Washington. Is that how you say it?
It's Sequim, Washington.
Okay.
Hi, Tom. Boy, I admire you so much. It's sad that I have to disagree with you.
Feel free.
I don't agree with anything this president has done. I'm a proud liberal, and I can't think of any good reason to support the guy. And Democrats under Obama's presidency have been forced to justify, explain, rationalize conservative corporate-based solutions. This comes across as a subtle long-term brainwashing with potentially terrible.
So when President Obama said we're not going to let private corporations do student loans anymore, we're going to federalize that, you didn't think that was a good thing. That was an $80 billion hit to the banking industry.
He hasn't acted on that, and every president and every promise that he made in the last election were concessions that he made in the face of Republican opposition.
To some extent, but enforcement of the child labor laws, credit card reform. I mean, there have been some. I don't want to be in the position of saying I'm here to defend Obama. I'm trying to inquire about the process. So, okay, so I guess the bottom line, Landon, is I got it. He's not good enough for you. And you've gotten the divorce. Good luck finding a new partner. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And that's ultimately the question, I think. It's not, you know, where are you going to go? Well, yeah, it is where you're going to go. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Clip 3, Shane, you've got that? Can you pull that really quick? One sec. Okay. All right. Never mind. That's all right. That's quite all right. Brent Colburn is on the line with us. Brent is the campaign communications director for the Obama campaign, BarackObama.com, of course, the website. Hey, Brent.
Hey, Tom. How you doing today?
Just fine. The president gave a speech today on economics.
Yes, he did. He did. We just wrapped up a speech at Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland, Ohio. And for those of you that were able to see the speech or hear it, I think that the president really laid out a clear choice in the election that's ahead of us in terms of the economic message and plan
for example,
presenting. For example, you know, the president is looking at a plan to grow the economy from the middle class. You know, he believes we need to invest in teachers, firefighters, folks that are out there doing the work on a daily basis. And I think you're seeing a sharp contrast between that and Mitt Romney, who really is echoing the policies we've seen before from the Republican Party.
So, Brent,
those are policies that want to grow things from the top down, and we've seen the results of that.
Brent, Robert Draper has come out with this new book, you know, Do Not Ask What Good We Do, in which he tells the story of how the night that President Obama was sworn into office, January 20th, 2009, this group of Republicans met over at the caucus room. Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Cooper and John Anson and Bob Corker, and Newt Gingrich and Frank Luntz, and made a commitment to each other that they would do everything they could to destroy the president's economic competence over the next 4 years so that he would be a one-term president. They have done that. How can the president grow the economy when the Republicans sabotage everything with filibusters in the Senate?
Well, you know, I think the president said it well in his speech today when he said, look, I'm going to work with anyone of any party who believes that we're in this together. He's open to partnership here, and he's going to keep making this point to the American people. You're right. They haven't stood up and done the things that are right, and they're out there choosing politics over results. And in this case, when we say results, we're talking about real jobs for Americans that are suffering. So I think it's up to your listeners, to voters, to make sure that they support the president in his reelection effort, and also to get out and work in state campaigns, local campaigns, and make sure we get folks in, regardless of party, that are willing to come together.
Isn't there a point at which the Obama campaign has to go into Harry Truman FDR mode? And, you know, FDR famously in 1938, I think it was, said, or 36 rather, said, you know, they hate me and I welcome their hatred.
You know, I don't think that's where we want to go right now. This is really about making sure that the vision is clear and the choice is clear in the upcoming election. The American people are going to have to make a really stark choice. And again, I think you saw that laid out today in Cleveland. And, you know, at the same time, Mitt Romney was across the state in Cincinnati. And what you saw from his side and what you've seen consistently from Mitt Romney is really someone whose only plan is to attack the president, to try to tear down what's different from him and offer no new solutions.
Right, and lie about what he's up to. I mean, it astounds me how I've said it many times in this program. The only way Mitt Romney can get elected president is by lying, and he keeps on doing it. But it seems like there's a point at which somebody should be saying that's a lie.
Yeah, well, I also think there's a point at which we need to say, and I think the president articulated this well in his speech, was we need to take some of this white noise and put it aside for a minute and really look at what's in front of us. Again, what's shocking about Mitt Romney is that it's not as if he's trying to hide the ball and what he wants to do. He's very clear about it. He talks about the type of plans he would put in place. You can see those plans from his time as governor of Massachusetts. He bankrupted the middle class there, and I think he would do the same in the White House.
Yeah. Do you have clip 17 or clip 3 now? This is President Obama from a couple of days ago, but essentially I'm assuming the same thing. Listen to this.
One of the biggest weaknesses has been state and local governments, which have laid off 450,000 Americans. These are teachers and cops and firefighters. Congress should pass a bill putting them back to work right now, giving help to the states so that those layoffs are not occurring.
Brent Colburn, we have, 27 months, I think, now of consecutive job
That's
growth
right.
in the private sector. But in the public sector, in the government sector, you have governors of red states all across the United States who have laid off 600,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the president's saying, let's put them back to work, but that's not part of the Republican strategy.
No, it's not. And I think it's important for your listeners to understand this, that when we talk about the importance of middle-class jobs like cops, firefighters, teachers, it's not just about the services that they provide. Obviously, they're an incredibly important part of the social fabric. But what's more important is that these are good-paying middle-class jobs. So every time you take a cop off the street, not only do you make things less safe in that community, but you're also taking a salary out of that community. You're taking a consumer out of that community. So these are investments not just to make us safer and make sure our kids have the long-term investments in education they need to compete, but also to make sure that we keep capital moving into these communities and really, like I said, grow the economy from the middle out.
Yep.
That's how we believe we should do things. That's how we believe we're going to get long-term health in the economy, and that's the vision that the president laid out this
morning. It's a very noble strategy, Brent, and I hope it works out for you. Brent Colburn, Obama Campaign Communications Director, thanks for dropping by today.
No, absolutely. Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. I genuinely wish them well. William in Coos North Bend, Oregon. Hey, William, what's up? William? William's...
Are you there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to ask you on your program, this is your program, I'd like to ask you as far as voting is concerned, I'm an elector, and I've corresponded civilly with Congress and with the League of Women Voters here, and it is very difficult, and I think it's everywhere, it's very difficult to find people here who share the commonality of voting. I find people that say, oh, well, we know that, you know, everybody here gets that, but we want to get to know you for something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that, I find that rather degrading.
So you're a member of the Electoral College. You're one of those people who, as an elector, and you're saying that the thing that concerns you is the number of people who just don't bother to vote.
Yeah, or people that don't want to, who come across at the level of finding that commonality, of establishing that commonality, and saying what can we do to get together to advance, Oregon, for instance. This would be anywhere.
Right.
To advance civilization, I find it very difficult.
Yeah. Okay. I don't have an easy answer for that one, William. Thanks a lot for the call, though. Up next, Mark Williams.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. There is a new, I guess genetic testing is not new, but the ability to do it at this scale on this level has grown substantially in recent years. And now there is, there was an article in the Telegraph the other day about how just with basically a swab of saliva from dad or mom, that you can look at 3,500 different possible genetic disorders that a kid might have, or, you know, obviously with amniocentesis and other ways, you could even look at them in utero. Now, stipulating that no one, liberal, conservative, regardless of what part of the spectrum you're on, no one, I think, in their right mind would say, oh, we should therefore be using this criteria or gender or anything else to promote abortion. I'm concerned about the very human dimension of this. Would you want to know when you were 10 years old or when you were 20 years old that you have a high probability of having a heart attack when you're 40 years old, or a high probability of getting cancer when you're 45 years old or 25? Would you want to know? Mark Williams is with me, conservative talk show host, marktalk.com, his website. Mark, would you want to know?
No, it'd be kind of like knowing the date and time of your own death. You spend your whole life just being psychotic about it. It's kind of, when we're kids, we fantasize about reading what other people are thinking about us, and the last thing you want to know is what they're really thinking about us. This is troubling on a whole bunch of different levels, way beyond the abortion thing. I can tell you, it'll take, with or without national health care, something like this could lead to insurance companies or even government single-payer system considering these tests, indicative of a necessary therapeutic abortion or something.
The insurance companies right now, I mean, could be using them. They have the precedent as
sure.
Pre-existing conditions. You know, you were born with this, therefore. But, there is actually a precedent for this, Mark. And that is... that for example, I know my mother's father died of a heart attack when he was 38 years old. She was 14, and maybe he was a little older than 38, whatever it was. But he was a young man. He was under 40 when he died of a heart attack. And so, she grew up without a dad, And I grew up knowing that there was heart disease on my mother's side of the family. And so when I was a teenager, I mean, this wasn't why I became a vegetarian. I became a vegetarian in protest of the Vietnam War. But it's always been in the back of my head that, you know, I haven't eaten meat since I was 16 years old. And I've always figured, hey, you know, that's probably a good thing given that my grandfather died of a heart attack. So I don't need a genetic test to know that, right? I mean, there's people who have, you know, multiple people in their family who all had the same cancer. You know, they all had prostate cancer. They all had, you know, lung cancer, whatever. And so you say, well, you know, I guess it wouldn't be a good idea to smoke if, you know, things like that. So we already have some indicators. And there is this field called epigenetics where, you know, we all apparently have genes that if they're turned on can become cancer or they can become heart disease or whatever. And there's certain ways that we can eat and conduct our lives that keep those genes turned off. So might it not be a good thing to know the enemy that you're facing?
I'm not
if you
sure
can do something
that,
about
it. It's not the technology or the knowing that really is, it bothers me. It's how it's eventually put to use. You know, like electricity, you can light a light or you can kill somebody.
Sure.
If this research and information is used to figure out how to alter, change, or repair those damaged genes or defects or whatever you want to call them, then we've got some brilliant research going on.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling is, however, that it would turn into a way for insurance companies or governments to control their costs by controlling who gets to live and who gets to die. And I, like you, have, you know, family history of the men in my family dropped dead early. The women, you know, they live forever. My cholesterol right now is higher than my bowling score. I don't need a genetic test to tell me that.
Do something about it, Mark.
But pardon me?
Do something about it. Let me tell you, vegetarianism is cool.
I'm almost all the way there now. I eat very, very little red meat, except in spurts. Every once in a while, I'll go on a binge where I've got to eat it. I think, you know, my goal in life is to go through life happy, leaving something better behind. And if I spend my entire life in this narcissistic mindset that, oh, I can't do this or I can't do that or I can't do that, that's a prison. I don't want to live like that.
Yeah, but the flip side of that is I know, for example, there's really good science on this, and I've been, you know, since my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer, we've really been learning a lot about this, that there are all these foods that you can eat that actually turn off genes that regulate cancer, that could cause cancer. In other words, it's possible to eat a diet that radically minimizes the possibility of you getting cancer. On the other side, there are things in our food supply and, you know, artificial hormones, from hormones injected into animals to hormone mimicking chemicals in plastics that increase the probability of getting cancer. And so it's not like living in a box. It's like, you know, I look at the street light before I cross the street.
Well, I think that by looking at the genes, though, we only get a two-dimensional look at what's going on. I mean, there's a great article in the Scientific American this month about the microbes we all carry around in us, and every individual is a completely unique collection of microbes, millions and millions of them. And
there's more non-human DNA in us than there is human DNA.
Yeah, and how they all interact with our genes and the environment and all that.
Yep.
It's unique to each individual. So I don't think you can apply a cookie cutter on it. And again, it's the purposes for what the research may be used that worries me more than the
research. Then given that this is out here, this research test that can, you know, find all this stuff, is it time for us to say, as long as we have a for-profit health insurance industry, you know, company, system, I guess would be the word, should we say you guys can't use this against us?
I don't know how we can do that. How do you legislate genies back in the bottle? How do you legislate that?
It's being done right now. Or a variation of it with Obamacare. There are about somewhere between 3 and 6 million kids. I've seen different statistics. Certainly a minimum of 3 million children in the last few months who are now insured, who prior to this time could not be insured because they had had a prior condition. They had had cancer, they had had whatever, and there had been a lapse in their coverage. This is why Mitt Romney, day before yesterday, was so careful to say, if you've been continuously insured, then I want to make sure that you're insured against pre-existing conditions. Well, if your coverage lapses for one day, suddenly everything that ever happened to you is a pre-existing condition. Obamacare says for children, there's no such thing as pre-existing conditions. You have to cover children. And so there's somewhere between 3 and 6 million kids who are covered right now. If the insurance companies, I mean, why not just say to them, you can't use a genetic test and call that a pre-existing condition?
We can do that, but that doesn't stop it. What happens, think further down the line. What happens, for example, if we do find ourselves with a single-payer system or government involvement and costs continue to explode, they're going to have to find a way to cut costs. And one way to cut the cost is the way they're talking about now, later life delaying treatment. One way to cut costs is to eliminate those children who may be born expensive to the system.
Do you really think, Mark, that the American people would tolerate that?
I think we're a boiling frog, and we're tolerating a lot today that we never, ever, ever, in your lifetime and my lifetime, ever thought we would tolerate.
Well, with regard to civil rights, or civil liberties, rather, I would not disagree with you. I think on the level of health care, time will tell. You're more skeptical than I am, I guess. Mark Williams, MarkTalk.com. Thanks, Mark.
Anyhow.
Great conversation. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, compromise or not, and genetic testing or not? Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I am... My goal in raising the issue of how do we engage people in politics who have given up and gone away was not to say, why are you upset or how upset are you? What the hell? Let's just see where it goes. Lawrence in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lawrence, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. When you ask the wrong question and when you make a wrong analogy in asking the wrong question, you almost always get the wrong answer. And what I'm talking about is the fact that the presidential candidates or president is not like a marriage. It's not a primary relationship. I saw Obama once from 200 feet away in Oakland at a rally, and that's it. I never met the guy. What's an analogy to my marriage is my family, my neighbors, my fellow workers.
Well, what kind of metaphor or analogy would you use to describe it then?
If you make the analogy that somehow the president is your primary relationship or like your spouse, you're putting putting the wrong direction on organizing. The problem now is not who's president. In 08, Wall Street gave most of its money to Obama. In this year, they're giving most of their money to Romney, but they're both aiming to please the banks and the corporations to greater or lesser degrees, but that's their primary reference for both of them. And it's not going to change through whether you vote for Democrat or Republican. Now, this is not to say don't vote for Obama. He's less bad.
I think what you're saying is what I was saying before is that without movement politics, we're totally screwed. To be movement politics.
That's almost right. Movement politics indicates the fact that it's political. You have to get to a level that is more fundamental than that. You have to organize unions. You have to organize community organizations. You have to organize in schools. You got to have a mass social movement, because the reason that all this money is working right now is because the American people don't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just heard a statistic the other day that the average child watches between 10 and 12 hours of electronic entertainment a day, either on the computer or the television or a game board. We're not social. That's why we get our opinions from the television and can be swayed by money.
What's your proposed solution?
So we have to organize people into communities, and labor unions have to be communities, which they aren't now.
Except that labor unions are creatures of government. The reason why you have almost 90% union membership in Sweden and 7% in the private sector in the United States is because their government is friendly to labor unions and our government has been hostile to labor unions since the Reagan administration.
This is true, but there have been many countries where that were more hostile to labor unions than the United States are, where people organized underground. You know, for instance, that was true in Chile.
And they went through 32 years of people being disappeared and tortured and executed. And
they finally managed to get out of it. They were in a worse situation than we are, but because they
had... You look at the Bachelet administration right now in Chile. Would you say that she's that much different than President Obama?
Wait a minute. Bachelet is out. Now they have a conservative in.
Oh, they do?
Yeah.
Jeez. Okay, I'm,
yeah.
I'm behind the curve. I'm sorry.
Yeah. The point is this, that we need... to organize on this very primary level, on the level of our friends, on the level of our neighbors, on the level of our workers, and that is where the main organizing has to go. Hello?
Yeah, I'm still listening.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. And, you know, what I do, for instance, is I get people to garden with each other. We have garden work parties. And the next stage that comes after that is that you have to turn every neighborhood into an all-purpose skills collective so that people will work for each other, whatever, babysitting, house painting.
You know what, Lawrence, it seems to me that the two things that will provoke this kind of behavior are either, and that I've seen in my lifetime, are either really hard times where people come together to help each other, or really stable times that are not, you know, wild and crazy bubble times like we had during, you know, Reagan, Bush, and Clinton, but the stable times that we had from the 50s to the 80s where people, you know, work, but they only work 8 hours a day, they have enough free time to get to know their neighbors, they stay in the same job for a decade or so, and they get to know those people. Communities form as a consequence of that.
This is true. That's what happened in the 60s coming out of the 50s.
Exactly. So either it's going to be stability or it's going to be crisis that provokes community. It looks to me like crisis is coming.
It looks like crisis, but here's the question that I want to ask you, and it's a favor. The problem is that because most of the country is, in fact, so asocial right now, you know, bowling alone phenomenon,
sure.
We don't form groups. What I would like to ask you to do is to put on people who know how to organize and have conversations about how to organize. We already know how bad things are. Mm-hmm. You know, we already know all the problems. And to talk more about how much worse they're going to get isn't a lot of help.
Unless
you talk about how to do it.
Yeah, okay, I don't disagree. And we have those conversations on here with some frequency, and we'll do so more of them. But you know, good point. Point well made. Lawrence, thank you for the call. All that said, well, we'll just leave it at that. All that said, that's good. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
How are you going to participate in politics this year? Welcome back. So what are we going to do? How do we do it? How do we engage people in these conversations? And genetic testing, Luke has some thoughts on that in Dubuque, Iowa. Hey, Luke, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Tom, only mackerel. Didn't know I'd get you. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well. Hey, I just wanted to say, first off, I want to talk a little bit about your ovarian testing. But I'm kind of a young buck. I'm 21 years old. This is going to be my first election. I wasn't really planning on voting, but, you know, you made the great point about how a lot of it has to do with the justices, the Supreme Court justices. So that's why I want to get out there, vote for Obama. I think he'd do the right thing, put the right people in.
The tragedy of America, and this is the big tragedy of the United States of America, is that in 1803, the Supreme Court took onto itself the power to strike down laws, and over the last 30 years, 40 years, the Supreme Court has taken onto itself the power to create doctrine out of nothing. In fact, arguably, they did that in 1856 with the Dred Scott decision, and in other words, to make laws. And neither of those powers, the power to break laws or the power to make laws, neither of those powers are given to them by the Constitution. You will find them nowhere in Article 3 of the Constitution. Or anywhere else
in
the Constitution.
They have more and more powers.
And they've become the most powerful branch of government. And they are indirectly elected by our electing a president. And that, in my mind, it's bigger than absolutely anything. But anyhow, you wanted to talk about genetic testing.
Yeah. Like I said, I'm kind of a young guy. And I know, you know, firsthand, the male side of my family, a lot of my relatives have died off from prostate cancer and aneurysms. Hmm. And on the female side, kind of like your Louise, I've lost like 5 or 6 members in the last 10 years to breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I had lived a kind of unhealthy lifestyle. I used to smoke a lot, drank a lot of really lot of soda, a lot of high fructose corn syrup, and I've kind of pushed that back, but I don't know if it's my age or what, but honestly, I'd kind of just rather not know.
Really?
And I don't know if you could shed some light on that or...
Well, you know, I mean, the genetic tests are not that expensive right now. It's a couple thousand bucks to find out a lot of stuff about yourself. And, you know, for a lot of people, a couple $1,000 is a lot of money. But I can tell you that for a lot of people, it's not a lot of money. And I don't see a huge stampede of people lining up for those tests. So it may well be that most of us don't want to know. I don't know.
It could very well just be ignorance is bliss. I do find it very interesting. And you talked a little bit about how there are the foods. There are the foods that
can turn on and turn off genes.
Can curb it or kind of accelerate it. And I've kind of am living more or less a vegetarian lifestyle. I eat only organic vegetables and fruits and organic chicken, no red meat.
Yeah. Well, you will live longer for it. Luke,
thank you so much, sir. That means a lot. And Tom, on a side note, I know this isn't really dealing a whole lot. I tried calling you guys on Friday, couldn't really get through. This is something that I think you should at least know about, that Fox News, your favorite so-called news network, is they just bought the rights to a Spanish station, Fox Mundo. Are you familiar with this?
Oh yeah, they're rolling out big time. Yes, they are rolling out an outreach to Hispanics just in time for the election. And
yeah, I love that the demographic that they're looking for aren't people who are concerned with immigration. They're more, you know, kind of middle class, upper middle class people, you know, who have more.
What they're trying to do, what they know is that Hispanics are tilting toward Obama right now, like 7-1, and they're trying to change that to 1-1. And I suspect that they will have some success. Luke, I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call. Gary in Battleground, Washington. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hey, back to the genetic testing thing. By the way, I love your show and I learned so much from you.
That's okay. Thank you. No need to say so.
I didn't call it a political day for some reason, but the genetic testing thing, as an old retired theater prof, I was quite familiar with a play called Oedipus Rex that dates from 2,500 years ago. Gosh. Sophocles wrote in that play quite a little bit about predictions they have the Oracle of Delphi. We have genetic testing and insurance companies predicting the future for us based on what we're going to do. And the whole premise of that play, it, at least from my perspective, has to do with the fact that there were predictions made about Oedipus's future. And his parents abandoned him, tried to exile him because they were told what would happen in his future, that he'd grow up and kill his father and marry his mother. Mm-hmm. Then he heard the same prediction as a young man from the Oracle of Delphi and went about trying to avoid his fate. Right. And it led...
But he ended up living his fate.
He lived his fate. He made it come true. If he hadn't known the prediction, he may have lived to be a happy old man without those predictions coming true. And I just think the Greeks were awfully, awfully wise about the human condition in so many ways.
So you're concerned, if I could boil this down, your concern is that if you... that if you know of the possibility of something happening, it might become a self-fulfilling prophecy. You're concerned about it. You're worried about it. Your behavior might change in a way that increases the probability.
Or you try so hard to avoid that prediction that you could bring on even other griefs.
Yeah.
You know, everything is a paradox.
Well, it's,
and you avoid this fate and take another course of action that then leads to your demise or your downfall.
Yeah.
I guess from my point of view, and maybe from the Greek point of view, it's better not to know.
Leave the Oracle of Delphi alone. Okay, Gary, thank you for your thank you for checking in and your comment on the record. Dick in Harrisburg, Virginia. Hey, Dick, what's up?
Harrisonburg, we'll get that one.
Oh, Harrisonburg.
I've been called the last Democrat in Rockingham County, and one of the things that I've learned a lot in life lessons. I'm over 65, and one of the things there's a guy, Len Silverfind. It made the great American flag. They put it in front of the Washington Monument. It was displayed there. But that's not the... I learned a lot from him. But one of the things I'm calling for, I asked the man who answered the phone, what happens? You went in and asked for a raise. He said, yeah. I said, you felt very uncomfortable, or did you feel comfortable? He said, I felt very uncomfortable. I said, well, if you would have had 15 people behind you, do you think that not only might if you got the raise, but you'd feel less uncomfortable, wouldn't you? And he said, yeah. And this is a mindset in our country.
Sure.
People are being trained to fear their employer, always worry that the next dollar they have coming is only going to be because that employer is willing to hire him.
Yeah.
And it's scary because I didn't live in that world. I didn't grow up in that world.
Neither did I. But that's that tragically, to a large extent, is the reality today, at least in particular. If you work, and thanks for calling and pointing it out, if you work for a company that is large enough that ultimately you don't even know the people who are making the decisions. You know, that a decision was made 2, 3, 4 levels up from you, sometimes in a different city. Oh, yeah, we're going to downsize the company. We're going to lay off 30 people or whatever. And boom, off you go. So, Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, I'm at my wit's end, and I'm sick and tired of people starting up their conversations like this. I'm a liberal, but I'm not an Obama shield. I'm a Democrat, but I'm not an Obama shield. I'm a progressive, but I'm not an Obama shield. Sheldon Adelson just gave Romney $10 million that we know of. You better start being an Obama shield from now to November. Stop it. I've made up my mind as of 12:15 Central Standard Time. I'm watching television, just came in from a job, me and my sons, and I cut on the news, turned MSNBC, watching Andrew Mitchell, and there's Ed Rendell, a Hillary Clinton Democrat, nipping at Obama's heel again about his strategy of taking down Mitt Romney again on Bain Capital. And I made up my mind right then and there. The Ed Rendells, the Harold Ford Juniors of the world, the Bill Clintons of the world, and all the other Hillary Democrats that's out there in the land in the weeds, and every time she's callable, every chance they get nipping at the president about one thing or another, I've made up my mind. If Hillary Clinton runs for president in 2016, and President Obama does not win this next election, and their fingerprints are on the blueprint to bring him down, not only will I vote for the Republican candidate, whoever he or she may be, not only would I vote for that person, I would actively campaign for that person against Hillary Clinton.
Okay.
This is starting to get aggravating. It's starting to get sickening. There are people on the right. These people don't dislike President Obama. They might not be slightly disappointed with President Obama. They hate him.
Yeah. And this is, again, this is why I asked his communications director, isn't it time to say these people hate me and I welcome their hatred? I'm going to fight back. And it concerns me that his communications director says, no, we're not going to fight back like that. Carl, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And back with more of your calls right after this, 45 minutes past the hour.
You can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, well, you might find.
Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Our Talk Radio News Service report is brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. Learn more online at germany.info. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, in the studio with us. Hey, Ellen.
You talked about the president's speech today in the great state of Ohio, in my hometown of Cleveland. But Romney gave the first speech, and he was in Cincinnati, Ohio, which, you know, I'm just from Cleveland, so I won't say nasty things about Cincinnati, but I'd like to, you know. But anyway, he said he's going to be a person of eloquence as he describes his plans for making the economy better. But don't forget, he's been president for 3.5 years, and talk is cheap. Actions speak very loud. He also said, Governor Romney, he'll say, well, but things have been doing good and help us create growth and put people back to work. Oh, really? Go check on that. So then, of course, the president hits back at Romney and says, Governor Romney and the Republicans who run Congress believe that if you simply take away regulations and cut taxes by trillions of dollars, the market will solve all the problems on its own. If you agree that, you should vote for him, and I promise you they will take us in that direction. If you want to give the policies of the last decade another try, then you should vote for Mr. Romney.
Yikes. That's, well, you know, it's kicking back, I guess. So what else is happening?
Okay, well, there's actually quite a bit of happening. Also today, Robert Reich has a new book out. He was on C-SPAN. He said that, look, we have to spend as a matter of sequencing. In other words, you spend this, and then maybe you spend this, and maybe you spend that. He said we ought to have triggers for cutting the budget, and maybe the triggers ought to be that the unemployment rate is 3 or 4 or 5%. He also said, look, all these people that say the FDR program didn't work forgot about the World War II, because World War II was nothing but another huge government spending program.
Yes.
And then he talked, about the tax rate, which you have talked about a million times. He talked about the wealth and what has happened to that as housing crashed. Now, also today, tomorrow is Gay Day at the White House. So the president is having a reception for gay and lesbian leaders across the country. It's also the second day of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. They had their meeting today. And for those who are watching on TV, I'm showing their.
This is a right-wing wackadoodle group?
Oh, yeah. Ken Blackwell introduced Ohio's Portman. Then Rubio talked today. And Ken Blackwell said that Rob Portman was inspired by moral agency. They all talked about how being a husband and father was much more important than what they did in politics. They did not talk about gay issues. Portman talked about life's pursuit of happiness and innocent life. However, we managed to get a copy of their Capitol Hill Day talking points, because they're going to go lobby the Senate this afternoon and tomorrow, mainly this afternoon. And what they're saying is it's appalling that the Obama administration refuses to defend the Defense of Marriage Act. This is in the same paragraph, Tom Hartman, that they're also talking about how important it is to have religious freedom.
Amazing.
It, 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 It's
religious freedom is a code word for we get to impose our religion on you. Just like free market is a code word for have the billionaires run the show and forget about elected officials. I mean, these guys talk in code a lot.
And then they have a one-pager that you can sign your name and get your neighbors to sign your name. And then they're saying through its silence, the Obama administration continually refused to defend the integrity of the bipartisan Defense of Marriage Act signed by President Clinton. Well, that was 20 years ago almost, however many years ago.
Things change, times change, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Which you're going to be hearing a lot from Mitt Romney about that. Yes, times change, I've changed my mind.
That's right. Okay, a couple other interesting things. Today, actually, there was a vote to unblock, to take a look. There was a 60 votes necessary for cloture to block the Ambassador El Salvador's nomination. Well, it seems that Senator Rubio had a lot of problems from Puerto Ricans in Florida and all of a sudden decided to gather enough votes to get through that 60 votes so that she could be approved of to be, again, another tenure as Ambassador El Salvador.
Is she Puerto Rican?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, the Hispanic senator is hearing from the Puerto Ricans.
Yeah.
And also, as Speaker Boehner released a video today about 30 bills that have been job creators, and there was, of course, nothing about the highway bill, which he is single-handedly stopping. We looked on YouTube to find out how many views this great new video that Boehner's put out, 302 views. My guess is most of them were from journalists.
Or his staff.
Right, or somebody like
yeah.
that. Absolutely. So yes, so that's the big thing that he touted today. Also, Secretary of the Treasury Geithner talked about how the only path for sensible deficit reduction, he was at the Council on Foreign Relations today, was in fact the Simpson-Bowles Act, Bowles-Simpson Act, depending on how you want to say it. He said the president's budget is different. It's not different in a major way, but it's the only sensible way to deficit reduction. And, of course, it has a lot of things in it to get things going.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else? We have another minute.
I see I'm like running through here. Mm-hmm. Tony Blinken, he's the national security advisor, not to the president, but to Vice President Biden. He actually was just in Iraq. He said he met personally with the Prime Minister al-Maliki. He said the United States is not going to get involved directly in the internal affairs. He said, but that they want things to be done in a clear and transparent way that does not actually promote violence. Also, interesting, in Time magazine, out today, actually, be on the newsstands this weekend, their cover story is seven Massachusetts Dream Act Dreamers, as they're called, who are undocumented kids who have gone to high school. And
big,
that is what they're doing.
That's great. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. Learn more online at germany.info. Up next, Dr. Ravi Batra, international best-selling author and professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, talking with me and with you about macroeconomics. What is the economic future of our nation? Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So what does the future hold, and how did we get here? Where are we at? What's the actual condition of the economy? What does the future hold for our economy, for our nation, for the world? To put some of these things in perspective, the original big picture guy, Ravi Batra, Dr. Ravi Batra, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, author of the internationally best-selling book, The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos, and Greenspan's Fraud, among others. Ravi Batra, RaviBatra.com is his website. And Dr. Batra, it's been a while since we've talked. It's been way too long. Thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me on your show again.
It's great to have you with us. I'm curious, just snapshot, where are we at right now?
We are very close to the to a second dip, what they call, or double dip, they call it, the second leg of the recession. I think in a month or two, we will start to see the rate of unemployment rising again.
Mm-hmm.
And especially after this year, unemployment will shoot up. The recession that has already started again in Europe is now coming to our shores. China is slowing down. India is slowing down. In fact, the whole world is slowing down. And in the United States, we have seen we had good job numbers early this year, but that's also going away now. So I think we are on the cusp of the starting point of a double dip in the United States.
Why? What brought this about?
Main reason is that, first of all, the government is wasting away time and resources. Right now, it takes about $1.5 million for the government to create one job. I'm not kidding. $1.5 million is being spent now to create one job in the United States. And how long can that go on? The budget deficit is extremely high, and they're wasting this money.
Right.
And if they had just, the average wage is below $50,000 a year, it might just be, we might be better off just to give them the money, $50,000, rather than spend $1.5 million to create one job. So
right.
We are wasting this money, and this money is ending up in the pockets of the wealthy who keep speculating in the oil market so the oil prices stay very high. In the past, recession would go away because the oil price would collapse. That was one reason why recessions would disappear, and the other reason was the revival of housing market, the auto industry, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But the housing industry is still very, very slow, and the auto industry is reviving a bit, but it's extremely slow. It's not fast enough. So I think we are wasting our resources, and then Europe being in recession means our exports into Europe are going to fall. So I think after July and August, we are going to see a really lousy economy in the United States. And then next year, what they're calling it fiscal cliff, right? So you've
right.
heard of that word, fiscal
right.
cliff?
Right.
That the U.S. Spending is going to fall sharply because of some tax and some laws that have already been passed.
Right.
So,
although they can be unpassed. But would it be
those laws, then we'd be fishing around at the bottom. But I don't think that's going to happen. It's going to be a negative turn
right.
now because it's just too late. They've wasted so much time and resources already.
Yeah. Would it be accurate to say that we had a period, arguably even a 30-year period, but a period that was a giant bubble that inflated it? The bubble has burst. The structural reforms necessary to prevent more bubbles and to rebuild the infrastructure, I don't mean physical, the economic infrastructure of our nation, haven't been done. The fundamentals are not solid, and therefore the recession will continue. Is that a reasonable characterization?
Well, no, the main fundamental is consumer demand.
Yes.
Consumer demand out of their own incomes, not out of debt.
Right.
For the past 30 years, the government has been luring or tempting the consumer to borrow money and spend it while following all types of policies that create stagnant wages or even create falling wages.
Right.
And if wages keep falling, consumer demand cannot be revived with debt.
So,
and now the consumer is not in a position to borrow that much more money. So the government is borrowing a lot of money to make up for that that shortfall. And so since consumer demand is stagnant, we really cannot expect a revival of the economy, because after all, the economy is mostly the private sector,
right.
not the government.
So which policies would stimulate consumer demand?
Or would give people the, I mean, would it, are you talking about increasing the minimum wage, increasing unionization, bringing back tariff policies or other policies that bring manufacturing back to the United States? I mean, how do you go about doing that, putting more money in the average working person's pocket?
Well, there are a number of things that the Federal Reserve can do. The government cannot do much more because it already has a huge deficit, but the Federal Reserve keeps bailing out the bankers.
Mm-hmm.
Not banks, but bankers. That's an important distinction. The bankers keep making a lot of money, a lot of profit, huge bonuses, even in a stagnant economy they have. They have huge bonuses. But what the Federal Reserve should be doing is to bring down the interest rate for the credit card customer. Mm-hmm. That's not happening. The credit card borrower, the person who spends money and borrows money on the credit card, they are still paying an average 15% to 20% interest rate, which is what it was in 2007 and 2008.
Right.
That interest rate has not come down at all. All the Federal Reserve has done is to cut the cost of funds to the banks, and the banks are making a lot of money, especially this bank, Chase Bank.
Yeah, Jamie Dimon's bank.
Millions of dollars in profit.
Sure.
And the cost of the government is of borrowing.
So we used to have usury laws. And, you know, it used to be, until the Nixon administration, that if a bank charged you more than 10% interest on anything, it was a crime. Are you suggesting we bring back usury laws? I mean, how can the Fed force banks or incentivize banks to drop interest rates on credit cards when those high interest rates are a major source of profit for the banks?
Oh, there's a very, very simple way. You won't believe I talked about this plan to Nancy Pelosi some 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
She was in Dallas, and I had a meeting with her for about 1 hour and longer. And I told her there is a very simple way the Federal Reserve can bring interest rates down for the consumer, and you don't have to pass any law to do this. So what they should do is this. You know, there are insolvent banks, there are bankrupt banks, and the FDIC takes over those banks, and the Federal Reserve supplies them funds and cheap loans. So what the Fed could do is to offer credit card service by itself. Right now. The MasterCard and Visa, and they offer these services and charge, and the banks through them charge 15-20%.
So have our central bank compete with our commercial banks.
You got my gist. Yeah, let the central bank compete with these banks. We tell the customers, transfer your balances to this bank that has been taken over by the FDIC.
Yeah,
you 5% interest on your borrowed money.
Hold on just a moment, sir. We'll be right back with Dr. Ravi Batra.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Check out Ravi, R-A-V-I, Batra, BATRA.com to see Dr. Ravi Batra's books and his writings. It's spectacular stuff. We'll be back with more Dr. Batra. Welcome back. What about money? All about money. Dr. Ravi Batra on the line with us. Dr. Batra, you're still here?
Yes, I'm here.
Ah, great. Okay. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia has a question for you. Steve, you're on the air with Dr. Batra.
How you doing, sir? I just had a question about, it was interesting because you were talking about you met with Nancy Pelosi and actually proposed that to her. But given the current administration and how hard it is to get things pushed through in Washington, for the future and the economy and jobs. Like, what do you think is the best way to stimulate job production in the economy that wouldn't have to require, it seems like a miracle, with, you know, our government right now to get anything passed as positive?
Well, I just suggested a very, very potent measure. If the Federal Reserve were to bring down the cost of credit to consumers, they have brought down the cost of borrowing to the banks. Banks are receiving money at 0% interest rate, but they are not passing that low interest rate on to their customers. And it's the customer who buys things, not the bankers. They actually raise oil price through their profits, through their speculation in the oil market.
Right. The bankers are basically the parasites in the equation.
Right. So we need to bring down the cost of credit to customers, and that will then pump in so much money. Imagine your interest rate falling from an average 15% to just 5%. That right. will be your monthly balance will be cut by one-third right away.
Wow.
Sorry, two-thirds right away.
Kirk in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KPTK. Kirk, you're on the air I'm a day ahead of myself with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Thanks, Tom. I hope that Louise is doing well. I haven't heard a progress report recently.
She is. She had a chemotherapy session today. She has four more to go after this, and so far it looks good. So anyway, thank you for asking. Your question for Dr. Batra?
Well, I asked this question right after an inauguration, and it was in a much different context. But Dr. Batra has had 3 years now to observe how President Obama handles situations. And you and I talked about this just a few days ago, how it seems like we're on the cusp of an opportunity for President Obama to call out the economic loyalists as FDR did. And it sounds like, according to Dr. Batra, that by the end of the summer, that's going to be a stark reality that nobody can run away from. So, you know, Dr. Batra has philosophized that we're on the cusp of the golden age. Is that imminent now? And how does President Obama see this moment, Dr. Batra?
I think President Obama is a very nice person, despite what many people think about him. He's a very nice person at heart. He wants to do good for the middle class and wants to raise taxes for the wealthy, which are very badly needed. It's just that she has bad advice, and when I talked to Nancy Pelosi, I thought through her I could find a way to talk to the president. Unfortunately, nothing came out of after that meeting. Nancy was very happy to hear the ideas, and she really admired them, but I guess it has stopped over there. Nothing came out of that meeting. Mm-hmm. But I think our best hope is President Obama. It's not Romney or any other Republican.
They've been committed ever since this meeting on the eve, literally the night that Obama was sworn in. There were 14 Republicans who met at the caucus room, this very fancy restaurant here in D.C., and basically swore a blood oath to block any kind of economic progress by the Obama administration in order to deny him a second term. Looks like it's working.
That's right, but I don't think Romney has really any chance. I think the president raised the question. The question is not whether we should create jobs, but how we should create them. And the Republicans have no answers. The president has some answer, but they're wasting. You know, imagine $1.5 million just to create one job which pays less than $50,000. That's the total.
That's a tough one. Yeah, Frank in Philadelphia, you're on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra. Frank? Oh, Frank vanished. Okay, let's go to Bud in Santa Clara, California. You're on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Oh yes, thank you. Just want to clarify what the doctor's saying. I think he's attacking credit card rates, which are high. Those are inherently high. Because of the risk, there's so many bad credit risks out there, banks have to charge higher. Mortgage loans, thankfully, are low because of the Fed action. The mortgage loans are helping consumers because of Fed action being low. And let me make one more point.
Well, let me just get Dr. Batra's response to that. Are credit card rates high because of risk?
No. If the banks were losing money on the credit card, they won't be offering them. Look at how much profit they are making. $4 billion per quarter is what Chase Bank did. And they should not be in a position to make so much profit when the rest of the economy is suffering. So it's not a high risk. It's just the interesting part is when their cost of credit has come down almost to zero. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't they reduce their interest rate even a bit to their borrowers? They should at least reduce the interest. That's the whole purpose.
But Jamie Dimon wants a new corporate jet.
Pardon my interrupting you. But my point, Jamie Dimon wants a new corporate jet is basically, you know, greed is running this thing, isn't it?
It's all greed, and that's what is ruining our economy, not just us, but all over the world. Look at what's happening in Europe. It's whatever money that ECB, the European Central Bank, offers to any country, it doesn't go to their consumers, it goes to their bankers. And they still make huge profits.
Is the Europeans...
All over the world, it's the same story. Consumer demand is low, production is high, and therefore... they can't sell enough goods, and that's why the government is then busy spending money to buy those goods. But where does the money? The money goes to the producers, those who produce these goods, because in a balanced economy, in a good economy, economic balance requires supply equals demand.
Hold on just a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We will continue that thought with Dr. Ravi Batra right after this break for the news. Check out RaviBatra.com for all of his writings. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us, the distinguished professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, the internationally best-selling author of numerous books, including The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos, and one of my favorites, Greenspan's Fraud, Dr. Ravi Batra, RaviBatra.com, his website. And Dr. Batra, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you.
Was there a point you were starting to make a point as we hit the last break? Did you want to finish that thought, or should we just pick up some more calls?
Go ahead, make calls.
Okay, great. Here we go. Sasha in Monroe, Washington, listening on AM 1090. You're on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Well, hi there. Since President Obama has just announced his intention to be on the middle class, can you tell us what you see for the future of those of us who are low-income, elderly, and poor?
Well, I think we have about two more bad years, especially the end, second half of this year and the next year, they will be bad. But after that, we will have new reforms in the economy, and then the economy will take off. So we unfortunately have another 18 to 24 months, which are bad.
So whoever is president next year will take credit for a positive economy, right? Whichever party.
By the end of their term, the economy would be humming.
Yeah.
All over the world.
Interesting. Frank in Philadelphia. Frank, you're on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen. I really don't believe cutting interest rates on credit cards really going to stimulate too much recovery or job growth or anything like that. You really have to get back to the basics. If you look at 1937, when this country went on a 40-hour work week, which 25 years before that, we went from a 50-hour work week to a 40-hour work week, you had people of labor arguing, okay, that we need to reduce the work week. John L. Lewis, Hutchinson, head of the AFL-CIO, head of the AFL back then, and John L. Lewis hitting him and formed the CIO. But we haven't addressed that problem for almost 100 years now, 85 years, okay? We still work 40 hours a week. We have technology today, out superior anything. We have an oversaturated workforce. We have women.
Frank, do you have a question?
I was suggesting there are many other things that we need
okay.
to do.
Dr. Batra, go ahead.
Yeah, we need to cut our trade deficit sharply to what I suggested.
Ooh, Dr. Batra? Dr. Batra?
We have to impose a tax on outsourcing. We have to break up the oil company.
Dr. Batra, if I may interrupt you, please. Your phone is just badly distorting. Paul is trying to call you, I think, right now on your cell phone. If we can change phones, can you try and say something now? Yeah, no, it's badly breaking up. I think the battery in your wireless phone is dying.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me just put you on hold, and Paul will work out another phone with you, and because that is just not working. What's Paul doing? Oh, he's okay. Line 12. Okay, Dr. Batra.
Yes. Can
okay.
you hear me now?
Now I hear you wonderfully.
Okay. That's what we should have done to begin with.
Okay. So back to your response to this fellow who was saying that stimulating the economy short term by dropping interest rates on debt is not the solution. We have to deal with labor.
Well, that's only one thing that we need to do. There are a whole list of things that should be done because we have a very, very sick economy, mm-hmm. like eliminating the trade deficit, a hefty tax on outsourcing, waking up the oil companies, waking up health insurance companies. I mean, there are hundreds of things, many, many things that we need to do to fix this economy. But the point is that once we do all those things, the economy will be fixed in a matter of 12 to 18 months, and everything will be humming again. So the thing is, the factories are all there. It's not that we have to build factories. The factories are there. There is just not enough consumer demand to buy goods that those factories can produce.
What happens if Mitt Romney's elected, or if the Republicans hold the House and Senate and they continue what they've been doing for the last 3 years of blocking any of the efforts to do the things that you just described? Like you mentioned the trade deficit. Nancy Pelosi actually got passed out of the House of Representatives a bill that would have stopped the tax break for offshoring jobs and would have given a tax break for bringing factories back to the United States. The Senate Republicans filibustered it because it would have created a couple of million jobs.
Well, I really want to use the Federal Reserve mostly
mm-hmm.
for a variety of policies, like eliminating the trade deficit. You have to get the Fed involved to facilitate this dual exchange rate policy that I have suggested. So you fix your dollar rate at a low rate, with respect to countries like China and Singapore and South Korea, et cetera, which have very large trade surpluses with the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And once you fix a low exchange rate with respect to your own exports, the trade deficit can be reduced very sharply.
Right. So you suggest.
I explained it in my books, but it will take more time to do it on your show. But it can be done, and the Republicans in the Senate won't have to be involved. The Federal Reserve would have to manage this policy.
Right. Okay. So we just have to convince Ben Bernanke.
John
in High Bridge, New Jersey, you're on the air with Dr. Avi Batra. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hi. Thanks for having Free Speech TV. My question is, Paul Krugman has said, everybody can't stop spending at once. And as you were saying, dropping the credit card rates from 15 to 5, would spur some more of that spending. Now, I run a small business, and the credit cards, actually, if you spend $100 with me, I have to pay between $1.55 and $3 to the credit card company, which could effectively not only, it could give you 3 to 6 months of zero interest just on the fees that I pay up front before you even start to pay the five. Now, that seems to me that it would really incentivize people making some purchases. And what would your opinion on that be?
Well, see, these credit card companies like MasterCard and Visa, why are they making such huge profits through these fees? The fees are very high. All that I'm saying is let FDIC take over some banks, which they're doing already. They should replace the management with their own people, then offer these low rates to the credit card holders, tell them, transfer your balances to us. We'll charge you only 5% and still make money. Mm-hmm. And then when that happens, all other companies, including MasterCard and banks, et cetera, they will have to lower their fees. It's true that they would not make enormous profits, but instead of earning, say, $10 million in salary, you should earn $2 million. Is there something wrong with that?
Yeah.
And let the money go to the people who need it and who can create demand. These rich people are not creating demand. They are using their money for speculation. They're raising the price of oil this way, and this that even hurts the economy.
Bill in Indianapolis, Indiana. You're on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Hey, how you doing, sir? Yeah, my question to you is, what can we do to have an economy that benefits all Americans and not just select few? Because, you know, when you really look at the situation as far as, like, job growth, that's not going to solve the problem, because you got many Americans that have jobs but are still struggling. We have what is a price control in this country. Cost is up because, you know, you got a corporation that focuses mainly on profits. We look at quarterly profits, and these companies don't work in respect of one another. We don't have a collective effort, you know, to grow this economy.
Well, what we need to do is to have new advisors for the president. You know, I have a very four-line short couplets, short poem. The goal of economics is to create prosperity for all, to remove poverty and unemployment for people big and small. That's the goal of economics. What they are doing is everything is for the big business CEO, and that's the problem. So the policies that I'm suggesting will create prosperity for everybody, not just for the rich.
Frank in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you have a question for Dr. Batra.
Yes. A few days ago, Tom, on the third hour, gave his description of what would happen if Romney were elected president. And it was my worst nightmare, actually, having those fears myself. But what do you think would happen if Romney were elected president? How would the economy go?
And we just,
if Romney were to be elected president, then we would have the same thing that we had under George Bush, the start of another very, very serious recession as happened in 2008 and no way out. So just remember what happened under Bush, and that's will happen under Romney.
Yeah, assuming that he pursues those policies. Now, if he did what Reagan did and just started spending like crazy and stimulating the economy, it might be different.
Well, you can't spend more than what President Obama is doing.
Yeah, okay. So we've already hit that ceiling has been built in. We'll be back with more in just a moment with Dr. Ravi Batra. Check out his website, Ravi Batra, RaviBatra.com. And if you haven't read his books, Greenspan's Fraud and The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos, I recommend you get a copy and check them out. Professor of Economics at Southern Methodist University, Dr. Ravi Batra. Right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More of your questions for Dr. Ravi Batra and mine right after this.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy.
Dr. Ravi Batra is with us, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, the internationally best-selling author of a number of books, including Greenspan's Fraud and The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos. Mike in Casper, Wyoming, you're on the air with Dr. Batra.
Tom, before you go further.
Oh, certainly, yes. Go ahead, Dr. Batra.
I just thought of something.
Mm-hmm.
Since I've already talked to Nancy Pelosi, and she was very, very, very impressed with this idea. She liked the idea a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I hope all your listeners send an email to Nancy Pelosi to pay attention to this idea and others with which we can revive the economy. It's not me alone who can do it. I can just offer suggestions, but somebody has to implement them. So I call upon all your listeners.
Uh-huh.
Be active today. And send an email to Nancy Pelosi. She knows of me now.
Uh-huh.
We have talked together. Ask her to implement the ideas that we talked about when she was in Dallas.
That's great. So email or call Nancy Pelosi's office. And if you're in California, of course, you can call one of the local offices. And if not, you can go to callcongress.org. And there are toll-free numbers as well as the main phone number that will get you through to Nancy Pelosi's office and suggest that she implement some of the suggestions that Dr. Ravi Batra made to her. Brilliant, brilliant. Mike in Casper, Wyoming, you're on the air with Dr. Batra.
Well, thank you, Tom, for a very interesting show so far. After listening to Dr. Batra, it seems like it involves a lot of nationalization of many of our industries. Isn't this getting close to socialism as we turn over control of the oil and the banking over to the government?
I didn't say a word about taking over any industry. All I said was break up the oil monopolies, break up all these big companies. You know, I heard one major big business CEO on CNBC the other day. He was saying we need to have these tax cuts again because they're good for small business. And small businesses create a lot of jobs. At that time, I wanted to send an email to CNBC. This man who's talking about small business has destroyed so many small businesses by taking them over. So here we have a great argument. Since small businesses create a lot of jobs, let's break up all these big companies and turn them into small businesses.
Hmm.
That's not socialism. That's mass capitalism. That's capitalism at its best, as Adam Smith thought about it.
Yeah, Adam Smith warned us about, and Teddy Roosevelt broke up the monopolies. John, in Oakland, New Jersey, you're on the air with Dr. Batra.
Doctor, just like to make a comment about this, all this talk about the credit card interest rates, how we should lower them. I think that's a disaster, and it would only hurt the more unfortunate people, because easy access to spending, and that's literally what it is, where they don't have the dollar physically in their hand, they rack up the debt, they buy things they don't really need or could do without. The banks are in the business to make money and profit. You make a choice to go to them, to that particular bank or credit card company, and I don't think we should reward.
But Dr. Batra, aren't you suggesting that not that people would go deeper in debt, but that instead of giving the money to the banks in interest, they could use that money to buy goods without their credit cards?
Don't give the money to bankers so that they lend it to the customers. Lend it directly to the customer.
Right.
Don't have the middleman or middle person involved in it. That's all.
Okay. Gary in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Gary, you're on with Dr. Batra.
Doctor, I'd like to ask you a question. I've been talking about it, the idea of employee-owned companies or co-ops. Instead of the 1% owning 80% of the jobs, we could have the people, you know, owning the jobs, and when they retire, they sell their stocks back to the company. How do you feel about that idea?
Well, that's a very good idea. In fact, it would happen. I'm going to make this forecast. It would happen in the next 5-6 years. I call it a case of economic democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, then people's wages or the workers' wages will rise in proportion to their productivity growth. That's what we need in an economy. When wages rise, as productivity goes up, that will automatically solve our problems. Why? Productivity is the main source of supply. Wages are the main source of demand. Now productivity keeps rising, but wages don't. So supply is rising, but demand is not. To make up for this difference, the government is spending money. We don't need that. We don't need the government to be creating so much debt for our future generation that it's not even working.
Yeah.
We need wages to rise in proportion to productivity, and co-op system that you suggested, or I call it economic democracy, that would ensure that this would happen under economic democracy.
And from the founding of the Republic until about 1980, wages did correspond with productivity, and then wages flattened. They've been flat for 30 years, and productivity has continued to increase. Do I have that right?
That's right. In fact, that's right. Until 1980, you may look at we've had very little debt in America. Even the consumers had very, very small level of debt. It's when wages stopped growing.
And then we went to supply-side economics.
Exactly.
Yeah, Reaganomics has taken us down. Remarkable. Dr. Ravi Batra, I think we've just got 10 or 15 seconds left here, so I just want to use it to thank you so much, sir, for the great education that you've given me and all of our listeners over the years and for being with us today. Thank you.
Thanks again.
That's much appreciated. And be sure to check out Dr. Batra's website, Ravi, R-A-V-I, Batra, B-A-T-R-A, .com. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there and and get active. And tomorrow, of course, Senator Bernie Sanders will be with us here. Brunch with Bernie on the Tom Hartman program. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.